We have come to the end of what seems like a very long mayoral campaign. The primary is Tuesday, and we have Seth Richardson on for a special appearance Monday to talk about how the candidates have wrapped things up. It's This Week in the CLE, the news podcast discussion from Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. I'm Chris Quinn, here with my colleagues, Seth, along with Laura Johnston, Layla Tassi, and Lisa Garvin. Happy Monday. It's a happy Monday for Seth because he's a Kansas City fan. It's a little less happy Monday for the rest of us because the Browns gave away a game they didn't have to give away.
Well, I'm really happy that you did the gloating for me because I was worried about having to do that myself. So thank you.
You can't, though, because I want people to listen to what you have to say. And if you gloated, they would just shut you down. So before you can do that, let's begin. How have the candidates for Cleveland mayor approached the final days of the campaign before primary day on Tuesday, when only two will emerge to face off in November? Seth Richardson, I didn't want to wait to have you on until Wednesday because it'll be over, and you spent a good bit of time with the candidates Friday and Saturday. So how are they ending their campaigns?
Yeah, I got with four of the campaigns over the weekend, and, you know, contrary to what we've seen a lot of other campaigns, you know, I think a lot of us are used to seeing presidential campaigns or even the congressional race that we saw just a little over a month ago. And with the mayoral campaigns, it was really more bread and butter than anything, right? It was basically a lot of knocking doors, a lot of not necessarily huge meet and greets, but things like that of that nature. So, you know, I caught up with Bashir Jones while, you know, he was doing a meet and greet over at a salon on the west side. I walked around with Kevin Kelly. It's very interesting. I walked around with Justin Bibb and Zach Reed as well, and it was very interesting to kind of see the different ways that they were approaching it, because they're like, while they're all basically, you know, kind of just knocking doors and canvassing over the weekend, you can kind of see the thought process going through the head and how they're sort of attacking these final days, because this is going to be a low turnout election. It'll probably be higher than it was in 2017, I would guess, but you know, with so few votes that are going to decide this thing, you know, the old cliche kind of holds true, right? Every vote matters.
So the whole goal in the final days is to get some people passionate to just get one vote at a time, to go out, get them to really, really like you so much so that they'll actually drag themselves to the polls tomorrow.
Yeah. And I think Kevin Kelly actually kind of put it best when I was asking him about, you know, why go this route instead of, say, a big rally in a park or rallying the troops or something like that, you know. And it's not like he's not trying to get his team pumped up or anything like that, but he said, you know, there's only so much you can really do at this end stage. You know, you can't get anything up on TV. It's really too late to kind of get another mailer out there or anything. Right now it's about making sure that you execute, and one of the best ways to execute, you know, and get votes there is to literally go to their home, you know, make contact with them, get that personal connection. It does make people more inclined to vote. There's a lot of, you know, data that shows that that's true. And, you know, it's also a case of making sure you knock on not all of the doors, because not everybody in the city votes, but making sure you really hit the right doors that give you the best opportunity to win. And, you know, that was really what I saw with the Kelly campaign. Like, they had a very sophisticated data program going. And I believe that they said they've knocked on somewhere around 120,000 to 130,000 doors. That's a lot. That's quite a bit. And that's through the whole of the campaign. That wasn't just through the weekend or anything, but, you know, seeing that kind of an action where, you know, there's a group of 10 or so, maybe a dozen, including Kelly himself, going up and, you know, really trying to make sure that everybody had the literature. And, you know, it was really funny watching him, because the second he heard a voice when we were in the precinct, he pounced on it like a jungle cat. He was there, you know, shaking hands. Hey, I'm Kevin Kelly. I'm running for office.
All right. Let me ask you this. Yeah. You're saying that it's that door to door stuff gets the passion, but we do know from Trump rallies and other things we've seen that when you get a lot of people together, that you can get that crowd energy. The problem is COVID. You can't really get a whole lot of people mm-hmm. squeezed together because so many people are afraid to do that. Right.
Yeah, that's part of it. And also, you know, when you talk about like a Donald Trump rally or a presidential rally, and even I would go so far as the congressional race, because it was such a high profile congressional race, there's just kind of interest in it no matter what, because there's millions of dollars on TV. You can't really ignore those races, right? They're there. How many people complain about ads that they see from the presidential race or whatnot, or from the congressional race? You know, the mayoral candidates don't have that kind of money. It's just not happening. There are some ads on TV, and yeah, everybody's getting mailers, but generally speaking, it's not as intrusive, I guess, as other campaigns really are. But COVID, yeah, that plays another part of it too. Do you really want to be the candidate who does have a rally of, you know, even if it's only 50 or 100, and, you know, it turns out that some people get sick from that rally? No, I don't think you want to be that candidate. That's because even if you make it to the general, that's just going to dog you the entire way, right? You're going to be the candidate who gave people COVID. So
can I jump in too? I just wanted Layla to make Tassi. A comment yeah. about that. So, I mean, yeah, you get a lot of energy from those rally events, but those are all your supporters showing up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not reaching the voter who's on the fence, who's weighing two candidates, who hasn't made up their mind. That's where that's why I think that, you know, door-to-door campaigning in the last minutes is going to really make the difference. Because, I mean, it's totally different in the presidential, you know, that kind of politics. Yeah, you get not when you have a big event, it's televised. You're reaching a much larger audience. That's not going to happen in mayoral, you know, in this kind of politics. So the door-to-door is the right strategy for this moment, I think.
Although, Layla, you've got to get people passionate because they're not going to go to vote. We know
yeah,
that there's a low
turnout. Someone who's on the fence isn't going to come to your rally.
Yeah, but you're not looking for the people on the fence. You're looking for the people that support you to actually show up. This comes down to who gets people to the polls.
If you're going to come to the rally, you're going to go vote. So they need to knock on doors. I agree with that strategy.
And I think the door knocking strategy, to your point, Chris, I think that, you know, it is really about making sure the people who would likely vote for you or who are possible to vote for you kind of get it. Because, you know, not everybody votes. Sometimes it's, you know, it's a little too, you know, I couldn't get down there today. I'll get them in the general, something like that. And when you do make that face-to-face connection, or at least try to make that face-to-face connection, it does make it much more likely, even if it's just a, hey, hello, I'm running for mayor. Really want to make sure that you get out there. Want to make sure that you either go early vote or, you know, turn your absentee ballot in or go vote on election day. And that does make people much more likely because there's kind of a personal request from the candidate. It's no longer just this idea on TV or in the mailers or even in, you know, the news stories they read. It's an actual candidate coming up to you and saying, hey, I'd really appreciate you coming out to vote for me. Could you make sure that you do that? It's almost a favor of sorts.
All right. So I'm not going to ask you to prognosticate because it's nearly impossible. We've heard so many different polls. The latest one was that it's a dead heat between Kevin Kelly, Dennis Kucinich, and Justin Bibb. But we've also had a lot of people saying they really believe that Zach Reed and Bashir Jones have a chance. So who knows? We'll see. We'll have you back on Wednesday, Seth, to talk about what happened and analyze it rather than today force you to predict it when it's such a challenge. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. How much have Republicans and Democrats spent to date on drawing legislative maps that reduce gerrymandering the way voters said they wanted them to? And what do we expect from a hearing about the maps today in Cleveland? Laura Johnston, they're nowhere close to the maps that'll be acceptable to both parties, but they've spent a lot of money getting there.
Yeah. So, and I expected that, right? I mean, there's a lot of money in the budget, $1 million set aside for redistricting costs. And Ohio lawmakers have spent about $173,000 of it on consultants, mapping software, high-end computers, hotels, and other costs related to the process. What's surprising is the breakdown that House and Senate Democrats have spent $115,000 on expenses. Republicans have spent just $42,000. That's mostly because the Democrats hired outside consultants to provide them with technical expertise. So you think, wow, the Dems are spending a lot of money, but then you think, wait, maybe they're actually getting people who know what they're doing rather than just saying, hey, here's how to break down so that we can keep the most seats.
It is interesting. The Republicans are relying more on their expertise, but I guess because they did such a great job last time commandeering way more seats than the population would support, they probably figure they're pretty confident. There is some thought that the maps they put out are horribly gerrymandered again. Mm-hmm. They have super majorities for the Republicans in both houses, which is not the way the state breaks down. And the two Democrats say they won't approve that. And if the Democrats don't approve it, it's a 4-year map. You do think that today in Cleveland, a Democratic stronghold, you're going to hear people blasting away. Do we think any of the members of the commission will actually show up? Mike DeWine, Keith Faber, Frank LaRose, Matt Huffman, are any of these guys actually going to be here?
I really hope so. I mean, yeah, they're meeting at 4 p.m. at the Community College Corporate College East in Warrensville Heights. And you're right. I mean, we've got seven people. I hope all seven actually show up to see what regular people think of them. This is written into the Ohio Constitution that they have to have three public meetings before September 15th when they plan to pass the final maps. And they're supposed to be getting feedback from people. But I mean, judging from the first meetings and what people said, they know what the feedback's going to be. The people that said they want fair districts, they don't want a 66% automatic to Republicans, I wouldn't think.
And no, the Republicans have not gone into this in good faith. They've shown from the beginning that they don't intend to honor the Constitution. This will end up in the courts. I do wonder if this will launch an immediate new constitutional amendment to take them all out of it. But we'll have to see. I mean, I got a note from somebody this morning saying, you know, what's unfair is we're having a hearing in Cleveland to talk about the maps, but everybody knows these aren't the maps. This was just a bargaining chip. The Republicans put out this obscenely slanted set of maps so that they can negotiate and continue to have their dominance. They'll end up with another set of maps and they'll quickly pass them and we'll never get to talk about those. That's a good point. They have to have these three hearings on these bogus maps. Then they might come to some accommodation and we'll never get to say anything about them.
Well, I really hope that these are bogus maps. But one thing I wanted to point out on the spending was that the Republicans spent nearly $6,000 to pre-reserve 40 room nights at the Marriott Courtyard Hotel in downtown Columbus. And remember, we talked about this on the podcast about the bunker that they had the last time that they drew these all up in a hotel room. And the spokespeople for the Republicans say these are used for staff to stay overnight so they wouldn't have to drive home tired after working late hours on redistricting. But it does make you wonder, like, what is going on there? And I mean, I do feel like there is a plan, that this was not just an open collaborative process.
No, not at all. This has not been the good faith effort that voters thought they were getting when they approved the constitutional change. We'll have to see what the next step is. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. Cleveland City Councilman Blaine Griffin once seemed like a shoe-in to replace Kevin Kelly as council president when Kelly leaves council at year's end. But does he now have some serious competition, Leila Atassi?
Yes. Yes, he does. And there's so many interesting facets to this story. Courtney Astolfi brought us this over the weekend as we head into Tuesday's city council primary. About a month ago, we had asked Courtney to cover the council races. That's how she discovered that progressive PAC is supporting a handful of candidates, mostly political newcomers. But she also naturally examined closely campaign finance reports. And in doing that, she discovered that Blaine Griffin appeared to be giving money to all of his incumbent colleagues. It's not out of the ordinary to make contributions to colleagues, but to nearly all of them was a bit strange. So she asked him about it, and he acknowledged to her that he plans on pursuing the council presidency. I mean, I think I talked to you about this, Chris, you know, when Courtney was doing the reporting, and you were like, well, yeah, that's like saying the sky's blue. We all kind of knew. But he put it on the record, said, I'm pursuing it. And of course, the council president is chosen by council, so connect the dots. And it certainly looks like he's trying to curry favor with the people that he thinks are most likely to make that decision come January. But then Courtney noticed another councilman was donating to fellow incumbents, Councilman Kerry McCormick. So what gives? She asked him, by any chance, are you also pursuing the council presidency? And what do you know? He is. So very interestingly, McCormick gave $250 apiece to two candidates who are not incumbents. One is Kate Warren, who's running for Kevin Kelly's soon-to-be vacant seat. And the other is Richard Starr, who's challenging Ward 5 Councilwoman Dolores Gray. And Gray, you might remember, was appointed to fill Phyllis Cleveland's seat. And that struck me as an interesting strategy, that perhaps McCormick is looking at that race and believes that maybe Dolores Gray doesn't quite have the staying power and that Starr is most likely to win. And he wants him to kind of walk in the door with warm, fuzzy feelings about Kerry McCormick and vote for him as council president. I don't know. But, you know, another interesting factor is that it seems a little premature to be campaigning for council president when we could see a wave of incumbents lose their seats. And these are highly competitive races. Not everyone is safe. Blaine Griffin is virtually unopposed, but Kerry McCormick still needs to survive a primary and a general election. And so do their incumbent colleagues who they're banking on for support. So,
but they do have a tradition of trying to line up votes ahead of time, because they don't wait until January to pick their council president. That's when the formal vote comes, but they get together in a caucus, you know, within a couple of weeks after the election.
They don't typically do this this soon. This is early.
They don't do it in the primary. That's true. I do think that Blaine Griffin has a harder path to it because of there's some departures from council that would have been votes for him. Phyllis Cleveland would have been one. And if enough new people come in, other incumbents fall, you know, he might have a hard time lining up what would seem like such a sure thing. And Kerry McCormick is out pounding away. So it's fascinating that there'll be competition for that. We should point out it's a very powerful position in, mm-hmm. in George Forum's hands. You could argue it was the most powerful position in the city because he exerted a lot of influence and the mayor had a battle with him, but it certainly is the number two position in the city. So there's a reason it's competitive. Mm-hmm. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. How is the regional planning agency called the Northeast Ohio Area-Wide Coordinating Agency stepping up in a big way to ensure that Irishtown Bend does not collapse into the Cuyahoga River and block shipping? Lisa Garvin, this has been a threat for a lot of years, and if that thing did collapse, it would cost a fortune and take forever to clear a path for all the ships that go up and down there. It would be very bad for the economy. So what is NOAACA doing?
Well, they're doing a couple of things. This Friday, the 17th, they will vote to award $12.8 million in COVID funds to stabilize that bank. This is all in preparation for building a park of about 23 acres. And for those of you that don't know where Irishtown Bend is, if you're on the Columbus Peninsula where Sinatos and Rivergate is, it's right across the river and downriver just a little bit. Also, too, and this is kind of interesting to me, the Port Authority has declared a public necessity to acquire a parcel of just under a half an acre near West 25th in Detroit through eminent domain. The issue with that is that acreage is currently owned by Tony and Bobby George, who bought it in 2018. There's an old building on the property. But the Georges have already signaled that they're going to fight eminent domain. So there's kind of like a fly in the ointment here.
Yeah, the Tony George often shows up in a controversial news event, and he didn't buy it. They didn't buy it that long ago, right? It's like 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, 2018.
That piece of land.
Mm-hmm.
And long since we've known it could collapse.
And he apparently part of his plans, I guess he wants to build like a restaurant, a wellness center, but a welcome center for the park. Now, why would a private developer build a welcome center for a public park? I don't get that.
Well, it's probably part of a gambit to raise the price. I mean, if you go through eminent domain, the government always gets the land. It's just what the cost is. What you end up negotiating is what it's worth. And I'm sure they'll get some money out of it. Trying to show that you had big plans for it probably helps if it ever goes to a jury to consider, although they usually negotiate it out. It's big news, though, to preserve that thing, keep it from collapsing. This has been something people have talked about for some time, and we've had a lot of rain this summer. It's mm-hmm. It wouldn't take a whole lot to have that thing just go sliding in, and that would be crippling. So it's nice that NOAACA is using its federal money to shore it up.
And the grant will remove some soil and regrade that slope to make it more amenable to a park. And then they're going to build quite a large bulkhead along that curve of the river as well with this money, or how far the money goes. We'll see. I'm very excited. I think, it's going to be a nice park when it's done.
Yeah, and good for NOAACA for stepping up. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. How much time does former Cuyahoga County Jail Director Ken Mills face behind bars now that a jury has convicted him of some of the counts he's faced? Leila Tassi, they didn't get him on a felony. They got him mm-hmm. on misdemeanors, but that still carries a potential jail sentence.
It does. Mills faces up to 9 months behind bars. And wouldn't it be ironic if he had to serve it in the Cuyahoga County Jail that he negligently mismanaged? I think that would be a creative sentence for him. He was acquitted, as you said, of that third degree felony tampering with records that carried that potential 3-year prison sentence. Jurors found him guilty, though, of two counts each of misdemeanor falsification and dereliction of duty. They had deliberated for 6 hours and reached their verdict around noon on Friday, and he's supposed to be sentenced October 8th. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost said in a statement after the verdict that, you know, Mills's oversight of the county jail, inmates and corrections officers, during that time, they were smuggling drugs into the jail. Inmates were denied medical care and corrections officers assaulted inmates. He said, with this conviction, Mills can think about his own potential time behind bars and hope that it will run better than the hellhole he ran for Cuyahoga County. That is harsh. So Mills's attorney, Kevin Spellacy, said that Mills will appeal the misdemeanor, but he's relieved to have been acquitted of the felony and that he won't have that on his record. He called that the big ticket item. In Corey Schaefer's story on this verdict, he talked to a juror who said that the finding of guilt was an easy one for the jury to arrive at, that the jury was swayed by the testimony of the conditions of the jail, specifically the description of a third floor holding cell that was commonly referred to as the dungeon. But the jury had a really hard time with that felony tampering with records charge and the accusation that Mills knowingly lied to county council. The jury, like the rest of us, also would have liked to see Armin Budish testify. They wanted him under oath to address Mills' claim that Budish had ordered him to monetize the jail at all costs. And the juror also said blame for everything that transpired at the jail could easily be shared up and down the chain of command, but only Mills was on trial. So that's the decision that was before them.
Although we in our reporting, we showed definitively that's what Armin Budish was doing. He was trying to turn the jail into a profit center, and in so doing, so jeopardize lives that eight inmates died in short order. I do wonder, you know, the criminal investigation that this all launched so long ago, you do wonder where it stands. Okay, Mills was the last person charged not to be adjudicated. There may be a couple of guards that I'm missing, but the main thrust of this seems to have concluded, but we don't know. They haven't closed the investigation. They haven't charged Armin Budish with anything. And this has been longstanding. He has to decide soon, if he hasn't decided already, whether he's going to seek re-election, and this cloud continues to hang over his head. Dave Yost's statement didn't mention that, did it?
No, it didn't. It didn't. And, you know, I don't know if you know, there's no evidence that Budish, like some of the others, like the, you know, Sheriff Pinckney, proffered or anything like that. I don't think there was any deal cut. At least that's not what our, you know, I really wish he would have testified. You know, it's a shame that we did not get to hear from him. And you know, there were, you know, answer questions unanswered that only he knows the answers to. I just, you know, one interesting thing about this that is kind of haunting is that Spellacy noted that the jail was pretty much the same under Mills as it had been for decades, and that it really hasn't changed since Mills left it. And, you know, I don't know if that's quite true. I mean, what was different about what happened under Mills is that they were trying to merge jail systems and cram way too many inmates into the facility. Yeah. It lacked the staff and the corrections officers and the medical personnel. That's how things degraded into inhumane conditions. Each inmate they stuffed into that facility was a chance to make some money. And I feel like that does lay at Armin Budish's feet.
Yeah, that's not true. It wasn't always that way. And they did make some improvements after all this came out, although it sounds like there still have been some issues. They recently raised the guards' pay to try and get a full-size staff of competent people. So we'll have to see how that goes. Obviously, the prosecutors correctly predicted that they didn't need Armin Budish's testimony to get the conviction. So they didn't put him up there and they got the conviction. So they must feel pretty good about that. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. How are some Northeast Ohio business-focused groups trying to take advantage of Northeast Ohio's relative safety from drought, fire, hurricanes, and other natural disasters that are plaguing the rest of the country? Laura Johnston, it seems like we may be the only place in the country not to be taking the ire of Mother Nature could that actually be an economic boon for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I love this story by Pete Krause so much. It quantifies everything we're always saying and thinking when we hear about another weather disaster somewhere else in the United States. Like, we complain about our weather here and snow and lake effect and grayness, but we don't have to worry about it being life-threatening generally. So businesses are trying to capitalize that, and they're calling us climatically boring, which, sure, we'll take it. The Cuyahoga County Department of Sustainability is working with the Cleveland Water Alliance and the Energy Policy Center at Cleveland State. They're going to develop something called a climate risk for business tool that would basically highlight our weather-related advantages in Northeast Ohio. They want to have a database where business can plug in any location in the country, determine their climate risk and the associated costs. This could be ready by next spring. And of course, when you create a database like this, you want you to come off better, right? Like you're going to be the winner when they type in a bunch of addresses.
You know, the thing is that even though I think one of the leaders said that they don't think anybody picks a business location based on this, you got to think if you're somebody that is in a decision-making role for a major company and you are in an area that has not had power for 4 days, mm-hmm. and you can't shower, and you might start to think, I want to get out of here. I want to stop having this as an issue. And the way the East Coast in particular is repeatedly getting hammered. Look, I grew up over there. I mean, I cannot believe how many horrible storms have hit there that I never saw the likes of when I grew up. There's something that has changed. And if you're in Texas, do you really want to continue this way? Plus, there's a whole lot of politics going on because of the what they're doing with abortion. I don't know. I think you might see people that are sick of it say, I'm just going to go to the Midwest where I don't have to worry about this and where they have an endless supply of fresh water.
Absolutely. And think about all the shortages. Sorry, Lisa.
No, go ahead.
Do you want to? Devin? Okay. I was going to say, think about all the shortage stories we've done over the last year when there's a shortage of foam for furniture or there's a shortage of this and that. And a lot of times it's not just been COVID. It's been storms that have hit factories or warehouses in places like Louisiana and basically put the entire production chain at a stop. And so you think like all these places could sell more stuff if they could produce it without stopping. I would think Ohio would be a good place to put manufacturing and warehouses.
Lisa Garvin.
Yes, I spent 38 years in Houston. And one of the main reasons I moved back to Cleveland is Houston is incredibly vulnerable to climate change. Yet thousands and thousands of people move to Houston in the Sun Belt every year, not realizing the risk until the next hurricane rolls into town. So yeah, I mean, I'm already thinking about climate change, and I think other people are too.
Well, and there's a hurricane roiling in that direction right now, so it'll get people down there thinking.
Yeah, and this has been going on for a while. I remember reading, that Buffalo was trying to capitalize on its position, which is very similar. But there have been these scattershot kind of efforts. Now we have the Water Alliance working together with the GCP. They've actually narrowed down 100 companies all related to the chemical industry that might have a reason to locate operations in Cleveland. And they're reaching out to them. So they're being proactive. They're not just saying, hey, maybe people will realize we're a great place to live, but actually going out and showing them.
I hope we don't have a tornado anytime soon. People will say we jinxed it. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. One more. How will the NASA Glenn Research Center play a role in a federal effort to cut aviation emissions by 20% by 2030? And what's the strategy? Lisa Garvin, the aviation industry does pump a whole lot of noxious stuff into the atmosphere. And as we try to deal with climate change, somebody's got to do something about that. It's fascinating that Cleveland will have a role.
It's awesome that Cleveland will have a role. Non-military aviation causes about 11% of transportation-related emissions, so it's no small thing they're trying to do here. NASA Glenn, their goal, as you said, is to cut aviation emissions 20% by the year 2030 and move to completely sustainable fuels by 2050. And their goal is 3 billion gallons to develop 3 billion gallons of a sustainable fuel. They want to test new green technology, looking at interesting, powerful batteries that they say that would allow planes to do a vertical takeoff and landing, which is kind of fascinating. And also looking into, you know, new engines that are more energy efficient and aircraft redesign, like slimmer wings, lighter materials. And hopefully, I mean, it's great that our research center in Cleveland is going to be the focal point of that. But there is still a question whether there will be more money and jobs that this project will attract, which I think it will. But it's just a win all around for NASA Glenn.
Yeah, it's cool, the science that goes through there. I don't think they get enough attention for everything they do. We should actually spend more time talking to them. Cool project. You're listening to This Week in the CLE. That does it for a Monday episode. Thank you, Seth, Lisa, Laura, and Layla. And thank you to everybody who listens to this podcast.